Why has the website stopped working between deploys? We literally changed no code.
Now it's time for me to bitch about it, because that's the only way this is going to be interesting. Daniel Rowe, am I saying that right?
Yep, that's me.
Fantastic. So I famously, on this podcast at least, use Nuxt for boot dev. We've built boot.dev in Nuxt, at least sort of as a backend for frontend part of our system. And you are the lead maintainer, the creator? Tell me how that works.
I'm definitely not the original creator of Nuxt. It was created by two brothers, Sebastian and Alexander Chopin. And immediately you feel like this must be an amazing framework, you know, to be created by two brothers named Chopin. You know, must have a touch of music about it. And it was created, I think, about the same time Next.js came out, a sort of Vue version of that, hence the U, so not Next, but Nuxt. And that started out, I think, really as a sort of template, Webpack configuration, server-side rendering template that let Vue sort of took a lot of the pain away. But very quickly, it became a lot more. It became a framework and came to version 2 quite quickly. I wasn't around for any of that. I was doing something else. I was building a startup, a creative agency, and then a SaaS startup. And we used Nuxt for some of what we did. And I started helping out on the open source side of things. When it came to version 3, we needed to rewrite it. So I joined the team, and a few of us, Puya Parsa, me, Anthony Fu, also joined around that time. And obviously Sebastian was around too. We rewrote Nuxt from scratch. So it sort of started again. And we had a rare chance to fix all the things that were frustrating about Nuxt 2. Hopefully learn some things along the way. And probably about a year after the release, probably about a year after I joined the team, we released Nuxt. And then a few months after the release of Nuxt 3, I was asked to take over as the lead maintainer of the project, which still has Sebastian and Puya as previous lead maintainers. So it's quite a star-studded core team, for sure. So I'm not letting it go to my head, but it's a lot of fun to lead a team made up of such brilliant people.
That's incredible. Wait, so are you full-time on Nuxt then?
I am. So I'm a full-time open source maintainer. I spend most of my time doing Nuxt. I have some other projects of my own, like Elk. I don't know if you're on Mastodon, but Anthony Fu started that project. I'm also on the core team of that. And a few other things as well, like Magic Regex and Fontaine and some other things I enjoy tinkering with. But yeah, I have the rare privilege of being a full-time open source maintainer.
I just Googled Elk, like imagining that I was going to find something about software. And then I like opened up the Wikipedia page and I was like, huh, Elk. It's the second largest species within the deer family. I was like, ah, shit. I got. Is it spelled ELK?
It is actually, but you might try going to ELK.zone, elk.zone. We'll take you. It's a Mastodon client, and The concept is that elk is one of the other animals around at the same time as Mastodon, but it's actually the only animal that survived. So we don't actually have Mastodon anymore. We do have elk still living around, and don't read too much.
I was going to say, like,
it's a nice
name. Live in Utah, and hunting elk is like a thing people do. Not me, but yeah. People. They're definitely around here.
So how big are they? Like, when you actually see, like, I've heard moose are just enormous compared to what you think they might
be. Moose are huge, and moose are awful, and they're mean, and it's like running into a moose in the wild is like sometimes worse than running into a bear because of how aggressive they are.
Goodness.
Elk I do not believe are nearly as aggressive as moose. They are big, but not like moose.
Goodness. I would never have thought that it would be worse than running into a bear. That is...
Moose will stomp you to death. It's crazy.
No.
I got to tell a story. Yeah, just like a couple of years ago, I was staying at a hunting cabin. Again, I don't hunt, but my friend's family has a hunting cabin. We went and stayed, did a little vacationing in northern Utah. And there's like this kind of little balcony around the hunting cabin, just like, I don't know, 5 feet for you to stand on. And down below, we could see moose just like hanging out below. And it was terrifying because like the generator died in the middle of the night, and we were like trying to watch TV and have fun and play games and stuff, and one of us had to go out and start the generator. And we knew that there's just moose, like so many moose outside, and so We like drew, we like put rocks in a bag and there's like one white colored rock and everyone has to draw to decide who's going to make the 30 yard dash to where the generator is located outside, dump the gas in, get it going and run back. Nobody got hurt, but it was scary. It was scary. We could hear the moose down below and nobody, we wanted to do that. I was probably 22 at the time.
That is crazy. And that's also very definitely not where I imagined this conversation going. So there you are. You were in a hunting cabin, surrounded. Like, I'm just imagining them like a enormous wolves, but looking much more ungainly, but like their eyes gleaming red in the darkness kind of thing. As you're sort of...
There was a lot of moose. Like, I don't know why there were so many moose there. To be honest, like, when I went, I had no idea there were even moose in the area. We saw several moose, you know, from 30, 40 yards away while we were staying there. So there's a decent amount at least. Okay, so you maintain elk. You maintain Nuxt. We are going to focus on Nuxt, but people can go check out elk if they want to. One question I have about Nuxt is, was it named Nuxt intentionally to confuse people? Are we trying to steal the next JS branding?
Yes and no. So it wasn't named for any nefarious purpose, although I did actually hear that somebody, the story of somebody who chose Nuxt for their project because they had an accent. And so they were trying to say that they needed Next developers, but they said they need Nuxt developers, and as a result they got Nuxt developers and
they
their project
Nuxt
was Nuxt. But that is not the point. That is not why it was created. But this was hilarious. Like I found the story. Nobody was telling it to me. It was just some tweet. Somebody was like, oh, there's a funny story about the creation of my startup, and it just happened to come across my feed, and I was like, success. the strategy pays off. No, I think, I mean, bear in mind at the beginning, you know, Next.js wasn't this amazingly popular framework. There was nothing to, you know, no confusion about it. It was just a sort of Next for React and Nuxt for Vue. And obviously we have different distinctives now, and we've evolved differently. And so now maybe it's a little bit more confusing, I guess. Although the worlds are still pretty different. It's just a bit of a shame, but it seems that a lot of people who are coding in React, you know, they don't want to touch Vue. A lot of people who are coding in Vue feel like they're totally different from people who program in React. And actually, these things are just tools, and programmers, we're tool users, we're artisans, and we should be able to use pretty much anything. So but that's a side point. So Nuxt, next. I think it was similar from the beginning, but I hope it doesn't confuse anyone.
At my last company, I was using React Native, which is very similar to vanilla React. I used Vue before that. Now I'm using Vue again. In my estimation, they are very, very similar. I do have a slight preference for Vue, is kind of the way I'd phrase it. I wouldn't say it's a strong preference, but I have a slight preference for Vue. It seems to handle a couple things through an API that I prefer. For example, I prefer the way watch effect works when you compare it to like use effect. In React, I think the API is a lot cleaner and it does things a little more. There's like less foot guns involved, is I guess the way that I would say it. While we're talking about this like comparison between Nuxt and Next, one question I have is, Next has been criticized a lot recently for like vendor lock-in with Vercel, because Vercel is this hosting provider and very famously they're kind of the maintainers of Next.js. And the criticism is basically like, yeah, you have Next.js and it's open source and everything, but it seems like the only easy and convenient way to deploy Next.js is on Vercel. At least that's being alleged. And my question is, does Nuxt have any similar problems? I happen to be deploying Nuxt on Vercel at the moment, but like, is it easier to deploy Nuxt by yourself than Next?
So one of our core values for Nuxt is, as in core values, because it's shared by most of the team, is the idea of not being locked in. So that is basically, that's baked into what we do. So Nuxt itself can be deployed anywhere. And we aim for all providers to be, people ask me all the time, you know, what's the best provider to deploy Nuxt on? And I really don't want there to be an answer to that. Because if there is, it's a fault on my end. So I want, from the Nuxt point of view, Nuxt to be equally easy, as easy as it is possible to deploy to any provider. So we support Cloudflare Workers and Azure Static Web Apps and Netlify and Vercel. And I mean, the Vercel integration is great, you know, zero config, so is Netlify. And we work as much as we can closely with the teams. So, you know, we've got direct channels of communication with the Vercel team, so that if something isn't working, they can ping us or the other way around. And that is fantastic. And I really, really love that. And I love the openness of that and not needing to feel in any way bound to act against the interests of our users. I mean, it just feels great. I'm a Linux guy at heart. You know, I think openness is the way forward. And it's not just the deployment. We have stuff like UnStorage, which offers a provider agnostic key value storage solution, which supports different databases, PlanetScale and Azure Blob Storage and Netlify Blob and Vercel, as much as we can. And ideally, I would like to see people making choices between these providers based on their needs. So they've chosen this provider because the pricing works for them, the reliability works for them, not because it's something that the framework needs. So I don't think the framework should be dictating where you deploy it. And that's absolutely a hill I want to die on. And I would want to do that with other things as well. So not just deployment providers, pretty much anything you can change in Nuxt, I would want you to be able to change. I wouldn't want us to lock you into anything. That's me and my soapbox. That's not a criticism of Nuxt, by the way. That's just my philosophy. And I think a philosophy a lot of us on the Nuxt team.
No, that's amazing to hear. First, I need to just come out and say it. Like, I am extremely grateful for what you guys are doing. Before we migrated to Nuxt, this wasn't even a year ago. This is like 4 months ago, maybe. Yeah, it had to have been. It's like really recent. We moved from a Vue 3 SPA on Boot Dev to Nuxt because what we were doing up until that point was using Netlify's like baked in pre-rendering. So what they'll do, for everyone that's listening that's not familiar with kind of how these systems work, is if you have a single page application written in, say, Vue or React or whatever, when that application is loaded by your browser, there's no HTML. It's like, I mean, there's very little HTML. There's essentially no HTML. And so like search engines will struggle to parse it. You'll have issues with like kind of social previews, things like that. A lot of stuff that kind of natively just works on the web doesn't work because your JavaScript needs to execute before you get a valid document object model or DOM. And Netlify and some of these other services have like a built-in pre-rendering. And basically what they'll do is they'll like attempt to pre-render your DOM by executing JavaScript on their backend systems or by just like caching the DOM and serving it directly before your application loads. And that kind of worked. It kind of worked for us for a while, but we noticed like when we dug into like Google Search Console and like our SEO statistics, like we definitely had some performance issues and they were due to us being a single page application. So like specifically some of our landing pages were pretty bad. That was why we decided to take the plunge and move to Nuxt. And the way I was looking at it in my head was like, okay, there is a cost here. We're adding another dependency. So now we're dependent on Vue 3 and Nuxt. But we're getting this benefit that we really, at the moment, like truly need. So all that to say, I'm very, very grateful to you and the team for tirelessly maintaining this open source project. Now it's time for me to bitch about it because that's the only way this is going to be interesting.
Okay. Okay. No, well, I was just about to ask, like, how did you find the migration? Is everything smooth? And I'm about to find out where all the rough edges are. So
we were up, I made sure first, my first step was like, I want to be all the way up to date on Vue 3. So like, I got all the way up to date on Vue 3 and like basically all of our dependencies. So I didn't have to worry about any of that. And then at the time, like Nuxt 2, or I should say Nuxt 3 was already out. And so I didn't have to worry about like any migration from Nuxt 2 to 3. So like that was great. I was just migrating in a Vue 3 single page app into Nuxt. And I did it in like 2 days. It took me maybe 8 hours. It was like, spent like 4 hours on a Saturday, 4 hours on a Sunday while the rest of my team was not working. Cause I didn't want to like deal with merge conflicts while I was like migrating everything. Honestly, went super well. The migration, like my goal was just to get everything into Nuxt and to get it running. I didn't go through and like change every little thing and optimize everything for SSR or whatever. I kind of did the bare minimum. No, that part, honestly, I have essentially no complaints about. The first thing that struck me strange was, what's the deal with the auto importing by default? This terrified me when I first saw it.
I hated it too. Like when I first saw auto importing, I thought, like, basically I was very skeptical of anything that was magic that's happening. And still, I think probably by personality type, I'm more conservative in that if something is working right now and you tell me here's a different way, I'm thinking like, wait, let's just consider this for a moment. Things are working. Let's think before we change. And I think auto imports, and I didn't think I liked it at first. Basically, I think we have, I think it's part of a bigger picture move from a monolithic framework to a composable framework. And this is why I think it works. So if you think about a framework like Express, a lot of Express's functionality is like embedded in the, if a lot of people might not know Express, I don't know. It's been a while since there's a release, and I think hopefully people are using other newer frameworks, but you know, it has a response request objects that look a lot like node ones, but then it also has extra methods like a res.json and so on that are sort of added and injected into those. And basically these are injected whether or not you use them. So if you never use res.json, like that function is still there. And it was a perfectly reasonable choice to make because it doesn't take up a lot of space. But when you think about a framework like that, you have to decide like what's the scope. We mustn't keep on adding to it because it'll just get bigger and bigger. There are also other problems now with serverless functions where actually space is very critical. And even, you know, 50 kilobytes is maybe not something you want to add unless you need to. So with the move from Vue 2 to Vue 3, where we suddenly had all these composables where people could abstract their logic and not inject them in a monolithic way, we also had to think about, so Nux 2 was very much monolithic. People had plugins, they provided like a single object to all of their components. It didn't matter whether it was used or not. Everything was just there. With Nux 3, Vue 3, there's this composable concept. So logic is decoupled, it can be used wherever. And that actually means that when it's not used, it can be shaken out of the build, which actually fits the whole move to serverless very well, and actually fits Nuxt very well because it means we can provide things as options. And so every function we provide is an option. You can use it, you can choose not to use it. If you don't use it, if you write your own version of it, then the next one won't be used, yours will be, and there's no duplication in the final build. And the only problem with that is what auto import solves, because the problem is when you expose everything as an option, but you have to import it to use it, it means that there's this extra point of friction. Okay, where's that thing? How do I get it? Where do I import it from? And IDEs don't necessarily get that right for you. You don't necessarily know. And actually the logic that should just be one or two lines becomes quite long because you have to pass all the imports and read through them before you even get to the logic. So I think auto imports can make it a lot more effortless to write the logic as though it was a monolithic framework, but with getting all the benefits of the tree shaking and so on. Now, if you don't like it, you can just turn it off because it's enabled by default, but it's not forced on anyone if they don't want it. But I think it actually solves those other problems in a way I didn't expect. And I ended up absolutely loving it.
The first thing you said about like, you have to specify multiple times when you want to import something. Like I did experience this frustration back when we were on a Vue 3 SPA. And in particular, before we moved to the composition API. So like we migrated from Vue 2 to Vue 3. And in Vue 3, you can still use a script. You can move to composition API. And when you import a component, you have to you have the import statement at the top of your script. And then you still have to register the name of the component. Yep. Like
components,
down in the code.
My component.
Component name.
Yeah.
Yep. And then up in the template, you put the component name, right? So like three lines of code to reference the one component. Then we move to the script setup tag. That got rid of one of them. Like now it's not like registered twice. So you just import it and use it. And now we've moved to Nuxt and I'm a defaults guy. If I don't like the defaults, I usually just suck it up and use them anyways because I don't like being dependent on like super nitty gritty configuration. So I'm like, if it's the default, I'm just going to do it. So we're doing auto imports. And yeah, now you just use the thing. You just like use it in the template. I will say ergonomically, it's really nice. And I've gotten used to it. And now I'm spoiled. And I'm kind of annoyed if I have to write an import statement. But by the same token, the thing I think that you give up is that you have to understand now when you're in auto import land, at least this is how I'm thinking about it, that when you create a function and export it, or when you create a component, it's effectively global in the sense that it's exposed to the namespace, right? So like, if you create two functions and export them in your utils directory and they're named the same thing, like you've got a conflict, that's a huge problem. So basically all this to say, we've adopted a practice of like using longer variable names, longer component names to be more specific because we understand that we're putting them up into this effectively global namespace. Is that kind of a trade-off that you've seen people taking?
I think that's a really good choice. And actually it's what we advise module authors to do, for example, because you can imagine an authentication module wanting to expose use auth, or a CMS wanting to expose something like use content. But if you think this is coexisting with lots of others, it's better to have a sort of common key. For example, I maintain the Nux sanity module, so you could have use sanity X, or you know, the Firebase module could do use Firebase something, or you know, like that kind of thing, which namespaces things for you. So I think that's a good call. It makes it clear. I mean, I think there are other things you can do as well if you want to distinguish what you're exporting from other files that might be around. So I think it's only the top level files in the folder that are tracked. So you can have subfolders, for example, which contain more stuff that you don't want exposed, but which might be necessary to those functions that are exported. But yes, in a bigger project where you have multiple layers, where you have modules that are exporting their own composables, you do need to be careful about namespacing them in a way that, which is, even if it's not about colliding, it's at least about clarity in terms of people understanding where it comes from. I mean, if anyone has a question, obviously you can go and click through in your IDE to the source. You can also look in your dev tools and see where specifically where it comes from, and you can actually see documentation for the composable in the dev tools, which is quite a nice way of doing it. But still, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't make it easier. And like by naming the composable, I think that is a very good call.
This brings me to my next question, which is, this is going to make one of us look dumb, and I'm pretty sure it's going to be me. So I'm more than happy to take the risk. Okay, so here's the question. We've got our Nuxt app for boot dev, and we have a landing page that is pretty static. All things considered, should be a pretty small payload of like what comes from the server to the front end that needs to be rendered on the screen. And then when you log in after that landing page, you encounter like an in-browser text editor, and like there's Markdown getting parsed and rendered, and like there's a bunch of fancy animations. So, like, that's pretty heavy. But our landing page, we want to load really quickly. And I only spent, this is why I'm going to look dumb, I only spent like an hour looking into this. It's just, I have not had the time to make this a top priority. But from what I can tell, when my landing page is being loaded, like all my components are being loaded. So like I can see in like PageSpeed Insights that like my code editor component is being loaded even just when I load the landing page, which doesn't reference that component. What am I doing wrong, right? Like, surely Nuxt handles this kind of tree shaking.
Well, it's probably something Nuxt is doing to make things better, but there are things you can do to change this behavior. So by default, what Nuxt does, it tries to get hydrated as soon as possible, so it's interactive for the user. So that will only include what is needed for that page, because we use dynamic imports. So every root has a different dynamic import. And so Rollup will split it out into different chunks. So that means that only what you need to display that page is needed to download for it to be interactive. Now, what happens as soon as it's interactive in the background is we do start downloading chunks for the pages that are linked to from that page. So if they are visible in the viewport, we'll start preloading them. Now, that doesn't actually impinge user experience at all. The page is interactive, JavaScript is running, this is just downloading in the background, so that if you click the link, it doesn't have to download it then. But sometimes tools like PageSpeed Insights don't know that. They don't know that. All they see is that there's network activity. They don't know that the page is fully interactive and ready to go, which is one reason why Lighthouse is a tool, but not like it's not actually your score. It's a useful diagnostic tool, and you should absolutely try and make those numbers go up. It's a point of pride that my website, I absolutely need it to be on 100 all the way across. But it's a silly target, because sometimes you will make choices which are good for performance and good for your users, but are not necessarily going to just give you green circles. It would be really easy, for example, to get all green circles by disabling JavaScript on your page. But what happens when someone clicks a link and it then has to download stuff for that next page? It's going to be a worse experience. So now, if you did want to disable that, you could. You have the option on each Nuxt link to say whether you want to prefetch the page that it links to. So you can set no prefetch on that link, and it won't prefetch. So for example, if you have the link to the dashboard, and you say, look, you know, in this particular case, like on a normal landing page, you know, about, contact us, these are all equally important. We want people to click them. But you might say, like, when someone is already a user, when they've already created an account, they're fine to wait for the chunk to download. So we're just going to set no prefetch on the link to that dashboard. And it means everything else about the site will prefetch and load, but just that dashboard bit is going to be segregated from that. And that will improve your page speed insights. And it might be a choice that you make because you think that the users clicking that link are going to be able to wait the extra 200 milliseconds or whatever, and it will speed that might be a good choice for you.
This is so nice to understand, and it makes perfect sense. Like, I'm gonna go like disable prefetch just to see and make sure that that's what's happening in my case, but then I'll probably just go leave it the way it is. It's like, as long as that's happening after it's interactive, like you said, I don't really care. In fact, that's better. And now that you say that, it makes sense why the rest of our site is so damn snappy, because it's loading everything in the background. Pro tip for everyone listening: if you have a question about a framework, 4 easy steps. Number 1, start a podcast. Number 2, get 40 episodes in. Number 3, invite the lead maintainer of the framework with which you have the question onto your podcast, and then just ask them directly. 4 steps.
Yep.
These things are this is how I run the boot dev engineering team. So does it only go one level deep? So like, for example, if my landing page has a link to, let's say we've got page A and it has a link to page B, but no links to page C, but page B does have a link to page C, by default, does it prefetch page C?
No. Nuxt is actually quite dumb in this regard. It just tells. So Vite is actually in charge of performing network requests when you try and import a module. So Vite has this sort of, because you know, like on the file system, you don't perform a network request when you import a module. You just load it using file system, like you use it, you node resolution algorithm and module loading. Like, it's different. So Vite does that in the browser so that it has like a little array of dependencies. And so when you invoke the preload function, it like fetches them one by one. And so all we do is we say, okay, let's find this link. And now view router keeps a registry of the link and the component, the page component that renders it. So we just take that component and say, hey, go ahead and import that component for us, Vite. And then Vite says, okay, I'll import the component and any other files that that component needs. And so it does that. But that means we don't go more than one level deep. We just do that first level of what is needed to render the page component. So if it then has more dependencies that are needed, if it has like a dynamic import, which is triggered. So sometimes you have something like a lazy component in your Nuxt app, and that's a dynamic import. So that will create a separate chunk for that component. And it's not a good decision if you are definitely going to use it. It's a good decision if you might not use it, but sometimes you might. So maybe on a mobile phone, you'll use that component, but on a desktop, you won't. So you'll make it a lazy one. So it doesn't load at all in the environment where it's not needed, but it will split it into a separate chunk. And in general, you don't want lots of chunks in your app. You prefer fewer, but then again, you don't want it to have an enormous payload size. So sometimes you want to split them out again. So it's a trade-off. So it will just do it one level deep, but definitely it's not going to be tracing links on the page that isn't yet loaded.
Yeah, that seems like the better sane default anyways. It's the default we actually went with within our app. We have this feature where like you're on a lesson in Boot Dev and we prefetch the data for the lesson on either side of you. So if you go forward or backward, you get instant navigation, but we don't go farther than that because we don't want to just like be sending crazy amounts of network requests. Same kind of idea. I have a question about use case. So one thing that's interesting to me about Nuxt is it feels pretty general purpose. Let me tell you about our use case. So we're using Nuxt as a backend for front end. So Nuxt, we deploy to Vercel, usually on the edge, always on the edge. How could it be usually on the edge? We deploy to Nuxt on the edge. It's like replicated around the world. That front end payload that is, you know, sent to a user's browser then just makes direct API calls to our backend that's written in Golang. It's just a JSON API, right? And that's kind of how the rest of the interaction works. Is that like the most common use case? Are we an outlier? What are the most common use cases for Nuxt apps?
I think the concept of a composable framework is maybe helpful here because we aim to provide the building blocks for people to build quite a lot of different applications. If it was a monolith, we'd have to pick. But because it isn't monolithic, it can be used very differently. So you could write your API in the Nuxt app. Right now, it's absolutely more common to see BFF patterns where the backend that you write in your Nuxt app interfaces with other APIs and, you know, caches them or parses them or adds authentication or, I don't know, does something to serve them up to the front end. That's more common because up to now, there are things that are missing in Nuxt from being the full stack framework that it could be. So things like Laravel. Laravel is an incredible framework, for example. I love it. It's got everything baked in. It's got databases, migrations, ORM, you know, it's all there. And one thing Nuxt doesn't have, for example, at the moment is a first-class database integration. If you listen to Puya's talk recently, you'll know that is planned and on the way. And so we want to give more and more primitives so that people can do more full stacky things. But it's always going to be fine to do it at whatever level you want or need to. You know, I mean, there'll be people who don't need any APIs. In fact, people who just build a client-side rendered app and don't even need server-side rendering, I'd like that to be a really good use case for Nuxt as well. You know, benefit from the DX, even if you're not going to server-side render anything. Because, you know, I'd like to think there are a lot of different things that would be beneficial.
That's like really reassuring to hear because I love Go and I love having our backend written in Go and you'd have to pry it from my cold dead hands. So, you know, my hope is that we'll just use Nuxt 3 as like a backend for front end forever. And we'll be able to have great control over how we do our pre-rendering and when we do our pre-rendering, because we do want some stuff to be on client side and we do want some stuff to be on the server side. And we want to be able to have that full control. And up to this point, it's been really easy to do with Nuxt.
But I think that ties into what we were talking about earlier. So who has control in your project? So, I mean, it's always a balance because if you give too much, if you make something too flexible and amorphous, then it can be hard to maintain because you're having to account for lots and lots of edge cases. But I think it is possible to give people options that allow them full control without creating maintenance burden for maintainers, as long as you design it in the right way. And as long as it's an active community that is able to report issues and provide fixes for the very weird edge cases that are out there. We want people to be able to do what they want with it. So I actively want it to be a really good choice for somebody building their personal blog or portfolio. And I want it to be a really good choice for an enterprise building something that's going to have, you know, millions and millions and millions of views. And it has to stand up in that kind of environment, as well as be fun and engaging for someone who just literally needs it to display some HTML pages that they're going to statically render and stick somewhere. And there should be no downsides to either party.
Yeah, I like I said, for our use case, it's definitely been, I mean, this is the thing, like I kind of just hate JavaScript. So like there's like that little chip on my shoulder that's always going to be there. But from the different JavaScript frameworks I've used, and I've used a lot of them, SvelteKit, Next, Nuxt, Vanilla Vue 3, Vanilla React. So far, I'm most happy with Nuxt and I'm glad we're on it, at least for our use case.
That is very nice of you to say. Oh, yeah. I should tell you, by the way, if you hate JavaScript, you can actually turn it off in Nuxt.
But then my app breaks, right?
Well, then you just have a multi-page app with no JavaScript.
Yeah.
But you can do it. It's possible. And do you know, like, I also regard that as a legitimate use case. So I even have a website deployed with zero JavaScript built in Nuxt because I don't need it to be interactive at all. So why should I have any JavaScript? The moment you do need something to be interactive, then the cost of the Nuxt runtime, which is like 50 kilobytes, it's going to be smaller than the smallest possible image you have on the site. Like it's a total no-brainer that you would want that. But still, I'm a hyper-optimizationalist, and if I don't need it, I won't have it. That's my philosophy.
So the interesting thing about boot dev, we've got blog.boot.dev, and that's actually a static site that we just generate with Hugo. So we like really have stripped it down. It's just markdown that gets generated at compile time and serves as a static site. There's no JavaScript on that site. And then we've got boot.dev. There is no way we could get JavaScript out because it is a fully interactive web app that's like running Go code that's compiled to WebAssembly in the browser, spewing confetti. So probably not an option for us, but good to know that we could do both things in Nuxt if we wanted to.
You could. You could make it the same site and set a root rule to disable JavaScript on the blog and not on the other. I mean, it's a subdomain, so maybe it's.
Oh, yeah.
But you could. It would be possible to do that.
Yeah, no, that actually is interesting because then, like, we do actually have this one little issue where people go to the blog and they're like, why am I signed out? And it's like, well, you can't really sign into the blog. We just have a CTA that says sign in when you're on the blog that takes you to the actual site. But if it was all one site, like, then we could just detect that you're logged in and not do that.
Yeah. So in that case, what I would do is basically turn off JavaScript for the blog pages, inject your own tiny JavaScript snippet that swaps out the sign out to a dashboard link based on whether a cookie exists. And so if the user has the sign in cookie, it's going to show them to dashboard. And it's possible, I guess, the cookie has expired. And so they click dashboard and it takes them to sign in. But that's less confusing than the alternative, I think. In most cases, that would be right. That would be straightforward. Like that would be the whole PR to do that would be, I don't know, I feel like less than 20 lines of code. You'd have a tiny middleware to make sure that any clicks to the blog perform a hard reload rather than client-side navigating, because you don't want any JavaScript to sneak in by accident. You'd have that little push of the script snippet to swap out the things, even in a site with no JavaScript. And you'd have the root rule. And I think that's probably...
And 400 markdown files.
Yeah, that's probably it. Exactly. Maybe some more than a couple of lines of code in the PR, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, however much markdown there is. Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, that's definitely something I'll look into. Definitely seems interesting. I want to move on to this question because this one's another one that like has really thrown me for a loop. When we had our app in Vue 3, there was I can't even remember. I think it was an index.html file. There's like an index.html file. We were using Vue 3 with Vite, and that index.html file would have like one div tag and everything would get injected in there. And when I wanted to update our head tags, say for like, I don't know, Google Analytics or something, they give you like a little snippet of HTML to put on the head tag. And you just literally just like copy and paste it into this index.html file and it's everywhere on the site. In Nuxt, I struggled a lot to figure out where to put this because there isn't an index.html file, at least in the default config that I'm using. There's like a use head reactive or something like that. It's like use head. And then I had to like basically figure out how to translate the HTML tag into like a JavaScript object. This is what I ended up doing. It was actually kind of painful and I was scared that I was going to mess it up. Am I doing it the wrong way or is that just kind of the way you do it?
Yeah, that's the way to do it. We do support. So if you do that in your app.vue file, then it will apply on everywhere on your site. You can also, we do expose some of those tags as components. So if you paste them in the template bit of your app.vue, it's not in the index.html and it's not in head, but it will teleport them effectively into the head for you. So you can try that, but don't do that for scripts. Everything else will probably be fine, but for scripts, which is most often what people give you to copy
and
paste.
It's always scripts. Damn,
it's always scripts, isn't it? Actually, we very soon have a better choice coming out for that as well, where we're going to be exposing Nuxt scripts. We already have actually, don't tell anyone. We already have used script shipped.
You're on a podcast. Don't tell anyone. Well, are we cutting this
just
out?
Just you and me and our closest friends who are listening to the podcast. And
okay.
We already have used scripts, which is shipped in unhead and exposes a lot of the functionality for this. And we're going to be releasing this very soon. I hope next minor, where basically we give people a lot better ways to implement script handling, like third-party scripts, in ways which improve the performance of their site. And because these are common problems across all third-party script providers, you want to inject scripts, but only if you have permission. You want to inject scripts, but only after the page is interactive. You know, like all of these kinds of things. And you really shouldn't be implementing them over and over again in lots of different scenarios. And like what happens when someone gives you a snippet to copy and paste. So we've had a great team. So Harlan, who is responsible for sitemap module and the OG image module and robots, like a lot, he's written a lot of stuff. Next SEO is his project. And Julian Huang, who has recently joined the Next Core team, doing server components. He's also been very involved in that too, as well as a team from Google, the Google Aurora team, have been involved also in helping from the performance side, chiming in with sort of best practice and the best ways of uploading some of these things. So I'm really excited about that. That'll be really, really nice to see when that comes out.
I'm excited for that. That'll be nice. If for no other reason than to let me sleep better at night when I'm copy-pasting things. I'm very prone to human error. I move fast.
It's one of the things that always frustrated me. When you, like, basically every third-party provider thinks that they are the most important thing. So they want you to put their script at the top of the page so it loads first. In fact, that's probably not going to be like, you probably, if you had a what do you think? Do you want your site to be interactive first, or do you want this third-party script to load? You might not necessarily want the third-party script to load. And they also ship you like a minified version of it, you know, which is outside your build step. So you might have your build step happening over here, but they've given you something else that's going to run. And like the whole thing is just very detached. And, you know, it's, I guess, then you have a tag manager or something like that, that basically gives more people in your organization the control to inject random things in your website.
Google Tag Manager is a disaster. Yeah.
Why is the website stopped working between deploys? We literally changed no code. Ah, wait. Someone,
the marketer, did a deploy.
A snippet in, and they have like the bit which just directly changes the HTML of the page. No, that's a bad idea. It shouldn't allow that to happen.
That's so funny. I remember like when I first heard about Google Tag Manager and I was digging into how it worked. For those of you who don't know, Google Tag Manager is basically like this service from Google where you inject the Google script, and then the Google script, you can go configure through Google Tag Manager to inject other scripts. So like it will change based on like what you have done in the Google Tag Manager console. And the idea here, of course, is that it makes it easy for marketers, right? Like, oh, I can set, like once you add Google Tag Manager, now the marketer through their dashboard can go deploy like a Facebook pixel tracker without having to change the code that's deployed on the site. Like you get what you ask for though. Like now the marketer can deploy stuff to production without having to go through a developer. So a bit of a double-edged sword.
It's very quick as well, because there's pros and cons, right? Like in a big organization, I mean, I've used Google Tag Manager, but at the same time, it is basically a Trojan horse as a service. That's what it is. It's basically you put this one thing there and then that then allows anything else to be done. And it can do a lot of things. You know, it can it can track, it can do A/B testing, it can change the content of the website, it can, you can even have, it does version control on itself. Like you can have different versions. It's basically like a little repository. You can roll back to versions that you know are working, you can see who made changes. It does a lot of things, and it does it very, but it does mean that, you know, at the click of a button, you can completely break something. I think the key thing I would say is that means that developers should be aware of it and involved in decision making and training of people who are doing things with Tag Manager, because it's not like that's the marketing domain and the developer domain is over here. Like actually, this is an overlap where you're giving control to people who might not be fully like. There's nothing you can do to protect yourself from that either. If you're building a CMS and you say, okay, insert, I don't know, make these changes. Like, you can expose just the customization that you want. But with Tag Manager or something like that, it genuinely is you are giving the keys to the kingdom away. So there needs to be some kind of oversight and some kind of training process that means it's the power is used responsibly and well.
Google Tag Manager, I feel like, can be related to the backend equivalent is giving your customer service representative like read and write access to your database.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Like, you've given them a tool that like now lets them get their job done in a more powerful way, and you don't have to step in as often. But there is a trade-off there, and I'm not even saying that's always a bad idea. You can have technical customer, you know, service representatives that know their way around SQL, but like, you just got to know, and they've got to be trained so that they don't blow up your production database.
Exactly. I mean, it's very case by case. I mean, I think in general, so basically it's an example of an abstraction. And we, as developers, we often tend to like abstractions. Okay. You know, rather than, because like the manual process is every time they need a script, they tell me, I put it in, we deploy it, manual process. And then we abstract it by saying, okay, let me create one master sort of control script that I'll just put that in. And then that allows them to do, you know, that's an abstraction. The key thing, of course, with abstractions is don't abstract prematurely. So try it and see if you need it. Do you need it? Is it just a matter of sending a Slack message to the dev performs a quick test and ships it? You know, if that's working for you, then great. But at some point, at certain scale, that doesn't work anymore. And then you really do need it.
That makes sense. There's always a little bit of a trade-off there. I have a question for you. This one will be more fun. As the lead maintainer of Nuxt, what is your favorite feature of Nuxt?
Do you know, I love the typing. I love the fact that you get strong types when you are fetching stuff from the server, like from your own internal server routes. I love the fact that you have, that we sort of will type hint things like possible middleware or the names of layouts, or like that genuinely brings me so much joy when I'm using Nuxt or building something with Nuxt. And I just like, it just helps me along the way. Like, that is so, so nice. Because I mean, I used Nuxt when it was Nuxt 2 and there was no TypeScript involved. And things have just come on so far, both what we've done in Nuxt and also in the Vue ecosystem. Volar is fantastic. And that the types that Vue itself exposes are so much better too, that it feels like there's just a lot of things looking out for you when you're coding. I don't know what you're like, you don't like JavaScript. Perhaps. What do you think about types?
Oh, I love types. I can't get enough types. Now, to be fair, that doesn't mean I like TypeScript, but it does mean I like TypeScript more than JavaScript.
Yeah.
And so the first iteration of Boot Dev was a Vue 2 single application in JavaScript. And now we are a Nuxt app with Vue 3, Nuxt 3 using TypeScript. And the developer experience is so much better. It's not even close. I take the struct that represents a JSON object in my Go API, and I paste it into my little tool, and it gives me the TypeScript interface. And then from there all the way down to where it's rendered on the page, I get type inference and type hinting the whole way. It's a beautiful thing.
I love it. I agree. I think that flow is right. Like, you define your type at the base or the top, whatever you're thinking, like the root of the source of the river. Yeah. Exactly. The source, I guess, rivers flow down. So like, you source of the river, that's where you define everything, which means you start at the back end. Like, you have, like, that's the right place to start. You type it, you validate it, and then it flows, like, then between like the Nuxt back end and front end, nothing's getting in between those, hopefully. So it just flows out. And then in the Vue template, because it feels effortless. You're not writing types. At that point, you've just written a validation in the server route. You know, you don't need any more. And, you know, you're getting the types in the template, which, it's good. That's my favorite, absolutely favorite feature.
I have to agree with you. I estimate that before we moved to TypeScript and Nuxt and Vue 3, more than 50% of my bugs in development, so like bugs locally that I was working through before pushing to production, were just types. It was just like, oh, I forgot, like, this is actually nested twice down in this object, or I misspelled something, or it was a capital letter or not. Like, and that was it. That was like the whole thing. And now that that's not a problem anymore, I just have so many fewer bugs. So fewer bugs in development.
Yeah, I've got to say, I love your images. Like, images through, like, they're obviously AI generated, right? You must.
We're now commissioning some. No, but really? Historically, we've just been AI. Now we're trying to branch out and get some commissioned as well.
That's what a great thing to do as well. But they're extremely, extremely cool. How did you come up with the idea for boot.dev?
That's a good question. Flip the interview for a second. So about 4 years ago, my wife wanted to get into coding. And she has a background in like math. She's always been really good at math. She was not very interested in doing front end work. She wanted to do back end work, but she didn't want to go get a CS degree. So I was basically like searching around, like, where can you learn back end development and like computer science, like the theory side of things, and kind of skip all the like CSS and JavaScript, just because like my whole background has been in back end development. I've only ever done front end development as a self-taught person to build boot dev. So I was trying to come up with like this educational path for it, and in my searching I didn't really find anywhere that was just focused on back-end development. It seems like most of the e-learning platforms are all centered around JavaScript and HTML. So it kind of came out of a few different ideas coming together. The first being a platform where you can learn back-end development in Python and Go, primarily a platform that focuses on computer science fundamentals. It's not just like trying to skip all the fundamentals and get you to a framework. That was like kind of thing number two. And then thing number three is I have a big passion for gaming, and I believe the best way to learn to code is to write code. So it was like, I want this platform where you just write a ton of code, and it's an extremely gamified experience where you're like earning badges and achievements and stuff like that. So those three ideas kind of coming together was the starting point.
I really like that. And like, I mean, it's totally matches my experience as well. I'm sort of very much somebody who I learn by needing to do. Like, I need to do this. It's not working, or there's no solution out there. So I'm going to figure out what needs, like, how this, like, when stuff is working fine, there's not a lot of motivation to change something. And I love gamification, the learning side of things, because it basically brings in the thing that is going to be the case when you're actually coding, like, outside a learning environment. Like, open source maintenance is gamified. It's gamified. I get, you know, tickets are created and people raise an issue, and then I create a PR and I get rewarded when it matters. You know, like, it's all gamified. And so like making the learning environment gamified as well, or like, yeah, you get a Jira ticket and you know you complete it and you get your sort of adulation from your colleagues. Maybe I don't know what your environment is like, but I think very few jobs are as gamified, because we condense things to ticket, like, this is your quest. Here's your quest. It's got, you know, like a difficulty level associated with it. You know, you're going to feel clever solving it. You know, you're going to do some good. It's going to be tricky. It's going to be a challenge. And actually, nothing we do is actually that difficult. Like, it's like things can be completed mostly. Like, if you're in a job where nothing you are doing is completed for 6 months, you will, like, you'll burn out. I mean, it's that, like, you know, that's really tricky. But a lot of what we do is bite-sized. It's like, yeah, do this thing, it'll take you 2 days. This thing, it'll take you a week. So all the time we're consuming, it's so much fun, right? Like, basically we're playing games for work.
My position is basically coding is inherently already gamified. Yeah. And like, we're just trying to dress it up a little bit, you know, like lean into the theming almost, which you kind of get the opposite sometimes. I feel like at least my experience at university was like, it was getting dressed down, because coding, like I said, already isn't kind of inherently a game. You have these tight feedback loops. When things work, you get nice console output, tests pass. But when you get like the theory reduced to like five questions on a piece of paper, I feel like that kind of takes the game out of something that already would have been fun.
It's possible to make it boring. But I mean, maybe I'm just saying that because I didn't learn computer science through a course. So maybe I'm just predisposed to think that. I'm not going to contribute anything original here, but I think sometimes what's taught is the sort of academic theory, but what's actually practiced isn't that theory and never was. And the theory is actually something you can very easily pick up from the practice. So when you start with pure theory, you run the risk of putting people off without gaining a huge amount, although it definitely does have some value.
In my experience, like, you've got this why that is like this looming question in students' minds. So for example, teaching Big O is something that I think is critically important, especially like when you're a backend developer, right? You want your query in the database to have some Big O complexity that means query go fast, right? Like at the end of the day, we care about query go fast, but if you kind of have this idea of like, well, I'm doing it in like a double nested for loop, right? Or if it has to join like N number of tables, like you could have these kind of blow ups in complexity and slowness. So understanding, you know, how to keep things fast is really important. But when I learned about Big O complexity, it was very abstract and it kind of felt like math class in the sense that like, we're just learning more math so that we can know more math. And my philosophy about teaching this stuff is like, okay, we're gonna go deep and we're gonna learn the theory that's like important to being a good engineer, but we need to understand the why and in particular, like how it ties into a real world application, right? So like, that's why every lesson we do this, just to nerd out about instructional design, which happens occasionally in this podcast. Every lesson is like, okay, you know, here's the Big O complexity. And actually this little function that you're writing is part of this larger application in make-believe storyland. But like, if you don't get it right, application goes slow. And that makes everybody sad, is kind of the idea.
When you're thinking about it from the perspective of how do I get the derivative of this, you know, how do I understand, like, I'm not sure that's going to help. But if you're thinking about, you know, just think about what happens as you scale this, like what happens when you get more and more and more hits of this, what tends to happen? Like, that's the same question.
Sometimes you just got to remove the jargon. And that's,
yeah, exactly.
And then like, you're there.
I mean, I say this as somebody, I loved calculus in school. Like, that was so much fun. Like, I was really into it, but I can't imagine that's, I think there's a lot more accessible ways to talk about things like optimization, performance. And
I couldn't agree more. What's the one thing about Nuxt that you wish you could just snap your fingers and have changed? So like, and I mean in like the most literal sense, like everyone in the world is going to forget that it was the old way and now it's the new way. You don't have to worry about like breaking changes or migration paths. Like, what's the thing that you'd just change if you had a magic wand?
That is quite... So, okay, this isn't that significant, but, and don't tell anyone this, but I would change the folder structure of a Nuxt project. So at the moment, it's basically everything in the root directory, and then you have like a server directory and plugins and middleware. And inherently, I think it would be better if you had a source directory, which is where your project lived, and then you split your configuration and your tests and your source code. And basically that just, it keeps things a little bit cleaner. It also improves performance because, so for example, there are tools, for example, so Vite, when it starts, it will like scan, or if you run Globby and you need to get some files, it'll scan every folder that exists in the root directory where it's run. That includes your Git folder, your node modules. It'll slow you down. And even if you tell it to ignore it, it still has to scan it because Globby supports like inverse ignore conditions, so you can opt in something deep down the chain. So,
oh no. So my Git folder is getting scanned.
Yeah. But if you're on the right operating system, it basically does nothing. So, but if you're on the wrong operating system, Windows, for example.
What's the wrong operating okay. No, we're good. We're good.
So, like basically the file system monitoring backends are different for different files, different operating systems. So Mac and Linux are different even from each other, and Windows is totally different still. And so like on Mac, it can basically start instantly without needing really to traverse things. But anyway, so it varies, and we're actively experimenting to try and improve performance in this, but it would just solve it instantly if people had their folder in a source directory rather than at the top level. And I think they should also have a separate server folder. So like a server folder, like an app folder for their like source code, and I don't know, modules maybe, and tests. That would be a really nice structure. And if everyone did that, I think the world would be a lot better. I might actually make that happen. Like, we might actually do that for Nuxt 4. So it might not be that far off. But I can tell you in advance, people aren't going to immediately like it because it's a change, right? So it's always going to be less nice. But I would snap my fingers for that.
I like those kinds of changes. I'm into the forward progress, especially if like moving all of my folders into a nested folder like takes about 3 seconds. So like that kind of a thing, I'd be you know, that's a lot easier than some other migrations I've participated in. One question I have for you regarding, like you said, you'd make a separate server folder. That reminded me of something I was thinking of earlier. A big concern I have with these kinds of frameworks, so Nuxt, Next, SvelteKit, whatever, where you've got like stuff happening on the server and stuff happening on the client, and it kind of happens in the same file sometimes. So like RSCs, React Server Components, kind of like have this idea. Or in Nuxt, you have your view components, and then like you can wrap things in a client-only tag, for example. Or you can put .client on the component. It will only happen in the client. I just want to get like, I guess, a feel for your philosophy on this, because when I first saw it, it scared me to death, because I'm used to a paradigm where I know exactly what's happening on the client, and I know exactly what's happening on the server, making it easy for me to like kind of debug performance issues, for example. And I got concerned when I have one file and things seem to kind of be happening sometimes on the client, sometimes on the server, or maybe both. Is this concern making any sense?
No, totally. I think we do slightly run into that danger. So the division we've made in Nuxt is not so much between server and client, as between the server API and the view part of your app. So like all of your view, like everything that's rendering HTML, and then like the stuff that's rendering JSON, like, but only on the server. So like if you write your index.view file, that will be executed on the server and it will be executed on the client. Like it will be in both environments. And in general, we want to say people should write their code in a way where that works. And a lot of the difficulty of writing a framework like Nuxt is to make sure that it does work, that you can run the same code in a browser and on a node server, or whether it's slightly easier, I guess, if it's Cloudflare workers, if it's more browser-like. But like that is tricky. And so we have to sort of guard against various issues with libraries. You know, you can't just use access window. Actually you can. In the latest version of Nuxt, we actually smartly replace window with, I think, undefined on the server. So if you just do if window, it'll know it's a server and won't do anything. Whereas previously, if you did if window, it would break. So it's running in both environments. But in general, you should write your code in the view part of your app that it's not depending on one or the other. And then that means that you put the stuff that, I don't know, needs the secret token in your server routes, in your backend for frontend. And that just gives you a very clear sort of mental model to separate out like the stuff that should be like safe and the stuff that the user can see the code of. Because every now and then someone's like, well, hey, I need my front-end app to make an API request, but I need the user not to be able to see the API key. Sorry, that is not possible. If you're shipping it to the browser,
yeah.
You want the browser to make the request. You are like the key is going to be there. It's you can obfuscate it, but you have to assume that your user is an incredibly talented coder who can just find it out. Like you, that's no. They're like, but I can see it in HTML of my page. Can you just put it in the JavaScript bundle? Like, there is zero difference between somebody being able to pull them up. And I think making that sort of mental distinction between like this is the view part, this is the bit where the user can see your code. This is the server bit. This is the safe bit. I think that's a good distinction. So we've talked about things. I've even built like proof of concepts on streams and things of exactly the kind of bling. I built bling for Nuxt, where you have like a little function in your view code which gets extracted and run on the server. But I don't know. I really think if it's possible for people to be confused by something, they will be. And so if you can, I will be too. Like, I'm not coming at this from a position of superiority by any means, but like, if it's possible for people to be confused, they will be. And once you let that API out into the wild, it's going to proliferate. You know, so you have to be careful. Even now, sort of sometimes I make the same comment on so many GitHub issues, and I think at some point, like, I've said this so many times. Where are people getting that idea that it's okay to do this thing? And then Alex Schuster comes along and does a video on it, and then nobody ever does it again. And I'm like, why didn't we just have him do a video from the first place? That would have been much more effective. But yeah, I think so. That model I like. But still, technically, your pages being executed in both server and client environments. So you could say that we fall foul of the same issue.
No, being aware of it is I think key. Having it like top of mind as you're doing it. And like I said, you know, we're using it as a backend for front end. So everything, we kind of just treat it as it's all front end, which actually just like eliminates a bunch of potential problems. Like nothing sensitive is even in that repository for us at all, for the most part. So it's just our use case. But anyways, thank you so much for coming on, Daniel. This honestly was like a really, really enjoyable conversation for me. And it's been absolutely fantastic to meet you.
It's been so much fun. I really appreciate you inviting me. And yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Anytime, for sure.
Fantastic. And lastly, is there anything that you want to plug to listeners? Where can people find out more about Nuxt or you or just anything that you're working on?
So... sure. So Nuxt is nuxt.com. You can check it out. We've got our docs there, already running the latest release, which came out yesterday, 3.10. I'm dating the show by saying that. Sorry about that.
That's okay. That's awesome. Yeah.
My website is ro.dev. So I write some stuff. You can find links to my... I basically stream sometimes me coding, which is basically an excuse for me just to have company when I code. So it's totally self-interested, but and some other stuff there you can check out if you want. If anyone ever wants to have a chat with me about contributing to open source, I also have a diary, open diary on my website, so you can book a slot anytime. And particularly if you feel like, you know, maybe you're from a different background or you feel maybe you're not sure whether you'd be welcome. So chat to me. I'd love to tell you that you are. I won't bore you with the projects I'm working on, but yeah, you can find most of them on my website.
No, that's an incredible offer. So for everyone listening, nuxt.com for Nuxt, ro.dev for Daniel's website, and he's got this open diary. So again, thanks for coming on the show, man.
It's a pleasure.